All right, so y'all ready to get started? So here we are in chapter 19. Chapter 19 is on international trade. And the first slide says, why trade with other nations? And the answer is, all nations can increase productivity, lower prices, increase jobs, and standard of living. So what we're going to learn in this chapter is that it's important for us to trade with other nations if we're going to live as well as we do. Now, if we didn't trade with other nations, could we survive?
If we
did not trade with other nations, could we make it? You know, America is a big country, richly endowed with many natural resources. The point is that we could survive, right?
Yeah.
But could we live as well as we do if we did not trade with our nations? And the answer to that is no. And what we're going to learn in this chapter is, well, how come that is? How come it is that it's necessary for us to trade with other nations in order for us to live as well as we do? So why is trade advantageous for all countries? Because the world's resources are not evenly distributed around the globe. See, even though the United States is richly endowed with many natural resources, do we have everything that we need to provide for ourselves, at least as well as we do? And the answer is no. For example, how many of you drink coffee? You got any coffee drinkers here? I make my coffee the night before, and first thing I get up, I turn the coffee pot on and drink my coffee first thing. Well, could we produce or grow coffee here in the continental United States? And the answer is, well, yeah, we could, except we'd need some big greenhouses because we don't have the climate that is suited for growing coffee. Now, if we were to grow coffee in big greenhouses and as much coffee as we do now, how expensive would that be? It'd be very expensive. And if it's expensive to grow, then what would the price be? And the price would be very expensive. Only the very wealthy could afford to buy coffee. So what we do is we say, well, in places like Colombia or Brazil, their climate is conducive to the growing of coffee, so let them grow the coffee, and then we can buy from them. Shifts in the economy, production possibilities, frontier. What this is showing us, you remember in way back in chapter 3, we had the production possibilities curve, and we were saying that if we were to increase our productivity, then we could push out our production possibilities curve and have more of both. Well, what this is showing us is a production possibilities curve without trade, and then a production possibilities curve with trade, meaning that we can have more of everything with trade. What is oligarchy? Oligarchy is a term which means a situation of national self-sufficiency in which there's no economic interaction with foreigners. And I don't know of any country in the world that is an oligarchy. I mean, there might be some very small countries, very poor, underdeveloped countries, but for most purposes, all countries trade with other countries. We don't have this oligarchy. See, how much do we export to other nations? And about, according to this, about 12% of our GDP is exported. What are the main products that we export? High-tech, industrial, agricultural, and entertainment. What are key imports? Manufactured consumer goods, which is a biggie, capital goods, oil, metals. Now, generally speaking, over the past, let's say, 20, 25 years, what has happened to America's productive capacity in terms of producing goods and goods? I mean, has it increased or decreased? Do we produce more goods today than we did, let's say, 10 or 15 years ago or less? And the answer to that is much less. And how come that is? You all know that we're in a financial crisis, right? And the cause of the financial crisis stems from our financial sector. And we've talked about this before, how businesses have, our individuals have invested more and more in the financial sector because the potential returns there were so high. Remember we talked about that? We talked about leverage and how in banking huge amounts of money were made. If you were, let's go back 10 years, and let's say you own a business, and you can invest in a business in terms of producing something and make, let's say, a 10% return, or you could put your money in the financial sector and make maybe 100% return on your money. Now, which would you do? Anybody would invest in production? Most investors look at that and they say, well, why should I put my money in a business that produces something if I can put my money in the financial sector and make so much more, I mean, 10 times more return on my money? And so that's what a lot of business investors did. People with money went more and more into the financial sector because the returns there were so high, and less money was invested in the production sector, and therefore, what happened to our production sector? Our production sector became a smaller and smaller part of our economy, and our financial sector became more and more and more, a larger percentage of our economy. Now, what happened when our financial sector started to go south? And that's exactly where we're at today. Okay, how much do we import from other nations? About 14% the size of GDP is imported. Have you ever noticed that when you go to the store and you look at many of the like clothing and other products and you say, well, where is this made? And the majority of it is made in other countries. A lot of it's made in China, for example, which, by the way, puts China in a better position than we are, because even though high returns could be made in the financial sector because of leverage, big losses are now being made in the financial sector, and it's all funny money in the financial sector. I mean, if you produce a physical product like China does, then at least you've got those physical products. The economy can go south, but you still got those physical products. You still got something to sell. You've still got something of value here. Whereas in the financial sector, if a financial instrument is worth, let's say, $1,000 and the market goes down and now it's only worth $500, then what happened to that $500? Well, it just disappeared. Okay, what are the terms of trade? How much of one good exchanges for a unit of another good? Terms of trade. We're going to talk about what determines this terms of trade from one country to another country. What gives a country's currency value? Now, what do you think? If gold and silver doesn't back up our money, then what gives our dollars value? I mean, why would foreigners want to possess an American dollar?
We got something back in.
Because they trade with American dollars, so.
Yeah, but why would people want the American dollar? I mean, if gold and silver doesn't back up our money, what gives our money value? What gives our money value are the things, the goods and services that we produce. You see, you show me a country that doesn't have anything that people want, then I'll show you countries whose currency is valueless on the international market. I mean, the only reason that people want to possess American dollars or euros is because they can use those currencies to buy things in that country. See, if we want to buy from countries in Europe, we don't buy with American dollars. We have to exchange our dollars for euros. If foreigners want to buy American products, it's just like, could you go down to the a local grocery store and buy your groceries with euros? No. American companies only accept American dollars. Well, same with foreigners. When foreigners want to buy from us, they can't use their own currency. They need American dollars. So what they do is that they take their currency and they exchange their currency for dollars, and then they buy from us. Now, if we didn't have anything that people wanted, then no one would want that dollar, and therefore the dollar would not be worth anything on the world market. See, what determines the exact value of the dollar? I mean, why can the dollar buy exactly what it does?
That's what it represents.
Well, I mean, the dollar has value because of the goods and services that we produce as a country. What determines the value of the dollar on the international market? That's half the story. What determines the value of the dollar in the international market? And the answer is the market. What is the market? You mentioned supply, but it's also demand, right? What determines the exact value of the dollar on the international market is the demand for that dollar relative to the supply of that dollar. See, when the demand for the dollar increases relative to the supply, then what happens to the value of the dollar? When we look at these things, we always have to look at it in relation to. Like if I say that the demand for the dollar has increased in relation to the euro, for example. Now, if the demand for the dollar increases relative to the demand for the euro, then what happens to the value of the dollar relative to the value of the euro? The value of the dollar goes up and the value of the euro goes down. But supply can also influence the value. See, for example, where has a lot of this money come from to finance President Obama's stimulus package? Some of it comes through taxes. Where else has it come from? There's really three areas it's come from. Taxes, what else?
Other countries.
Well, in terms of borrowing, and a lot of that is borrowed from other countries, but it's also borrowed from Americans. You know, Americans that buy savings bonds or other type of government bonds. But where's the third area that we're getting money to fund these? Our deficit is going to increase this year, 2009, by $2 trillion. Now, where's a lot of that money coming from? I mean, other than taxes, other than borrowing, where's it coming from?
Out of thin air.
Out of thin air. Exactly. That's exactly right. The third place we can get the money is simply to create it. First of all, who creates money? Can the federal government create money?
Oh, not the...
No. Who creates money? It's not the federal government. Who creates money?
The Reserve.
The Federal Reserve, exactly right. The Federal Reserve is the one who creates money. Now, when the federal government borrows money by selling bonds, they can sell these bonds to the Federal Reserve, and the Federal Reserve can create money to buy these bonds, and we call that monetizing the debt. In fact, the Federal Reserve can do this in many different cases. It can go to the open market and buy bonds from anybody and create the money to buy those bonds. What's happened here is that when we monetize the debt, when the Federal Reserve creates money to buy financial instruments from other banks and even other businesses, what's happening now to the money supply relative to demand? Now, we've got newly created money here, right?
Yeah.
All right, the government takes this newly created money made out of thin air. It's just an electronic impulse on a computer. It's not backed up by anything. It's just we just push a few keys on the computer and we credit, you know, we just add a few zeros and voila, we got money. I mean, just out of thin air. I mean, that was a good answer, out of thin air. All right, so now that we take this newly created money and we put it into circulation. Well, what's happening now to the supply of money? The supply of money on the world market is going to increase, and everything else being equal, what's going to happen to the value of the dollar on the international market, therefore?
Yeah.
It's going to go down. See, these are the things that affect what we're talking about here, is what See, the American dollar has value because Americans have things, goods and services, financial instruments that foreigners want, and they need dollars to buy those things. But what determines the exact value of the dollar on the international market? The answer is the market. What is the market? The market is the demand and supply of the American dollar on the international market. Now, when we create money, lots of money, and put it out there in the circulation, what happens to the supply of money on the international market, or the supply of dollars on the international market? The supply increases, and therefore what happens to the value? The value goes down. Now, when the value of the dollar goes down, what happens to our ability as Americans to buy from foreigners? Yeah, more expensive. Exactly right. When we buy something from Europe, for example, if the dollar has fallen in value relative to the euro, then when we want to buy things from Europe, we have to exchange our dollars for euros. But if our dollars has a lower value, it's going to take more of them when we exchange for euros to buy what we want from Europe. And so, in essence, those things from Europe become more expensive for us because we had to give up more dollars. Now, if the value of the dollar has gone down relative to the value of the euro, then when the Europeans want to buy from us, what happens?
Costs less for them.
Yeah, it costs less for them. See, that's the flip side of the coin. If the dollar is worth less relative to the euro, then the euro is worth more relative to the dollar. Therefore, when people from Europe buy from America, then American prices are actually lower. You know, over the recent past, we've drawn people from foreign countries. When they travel in America, I mean, for them it's like Christmas. I mean, they get giddy because, wow, look at all these great deals they get. See, for them, it's cheaper. Now, for us, it may not be cheaper, but for them it is, because when they take their currency and trade them in for dollars, well, they're going to get more dollars as the value of the dollar has gone down and the value of their currency has gone up. So, in essence, when they buy things, they can exchange euros for dollars, and so when they go buy things, well, prices are very low. Prices may be high for us, but low for them. Okay, so what I was talking about here is slide 11. What gives a country's currency value? It has something that other countries want. What determines the value of a country's currency? I've got ahead of myself here. The demand and supply of that currency on the international market. So when we say the demand for a currency, what that means is that foreigners want to say, oh, we want to buy something from America, so we have to get our hands on dollars. And the way they do that is they exchange their currency for those dollars. Well, that is what we mean by the demand for the dollar. When people say, it's just like when, what do we call the demand for money? Well, how does one demand money in the economy? Well, if you go to a job and you work for money, are you demanding money? Well, that's not what we call demanding money, no. When we're talking about the demand for money, we're talking about people who go to a bank and they want to say, hey, I want to borrow money. That's the demand for money. When foreigners want to buy something from America, and they say, we've got to exchange our currency for dollars, then when they do that, when they take action, when they actually go somewhere and they say, hey, I've got so many euros and I want to exchange these for dollars, that is what we mean by the demand for the dollar increases. This is a market, and there's a demand and supply for currencies. And see, what determines the value of anything in a free market? Well, what determines the value of anything in a free market is the demand and supply for that something. Now, what you got to do is you got to take currencies and recognize that currencies are just something else that has value. See, what gives anything value? What two things give anything value? Hey, why does this computer have value? Why does this monitor have value? Why does that door over there have value? What gives anything value?
Usefulness.
Well, number one is usefulness, and number two is level of scarcity. See, something can be very useful, like water, but if it's not very scarce, then it still will have a low value, right? Or something can be very rare, let's say, not scarce, but very rare, and yet it not have much value because it may not be useful. See, it takes both. Now, you show me something that is very useful and very scarce, then that something will have value. Now, what value does it have? It depends on how useful it is and how scarce it is. Now, that door over there has value because it's useful and relatively scarce. This computer monitor here has value because it's useful and relatively scarce. A dollar has value, or any currency has value, because it's useful and relatively scarce. See, the point I'm making is that what gives any country's currency value is the same thing that gives anything value. The only difference between a country's currency and something else, like a TV set, is they have different uses. Money is used for certain things, and a TV is used for certain things. They're both useful, and they're both relatively scarce. So they both have value in the market. See, what we're talking about here is value for a country's currencies. See, what are our main trading partners? Canada, Japan, Mexico. Notice here that Canada and Mexico are two of our main trading partners because we share such a large border with these two countries, and therefore they are our main trading partners. Okay, which country do we trade the most with? Canada, which is why is Canada and Mexico, for that matter, both very upset with us since the stimulus package here of the Obama administration. I mean, we're virtually in the throes of a trade war with Mexico, and we could be with one with Canada, our two main trading partners. And how come? What is it with the stimulus package, the 2009, that has got our trading partners so upset? Well, see, what Congress did is that they, when they came up with the stimulus package, they put a provision in there, and they said, if we give money to a company, then we're going to require that company to buy American resources instead of foreign resources, like from Canada or Mexico. Of course, they're thinking, well, if we're going to give money to an American company and we're trying to stimulate American jobs, then a provision of that money, because there are always strings attached, right? The government never just gives money and then walks away. The government always uses that giving of money as leverage for them to dictate policy. And so what we've got here is say, well, if we give you money, then we want to make sure that you use that money to buy from American companies and not from Canada or Mexico. Well, let's say that there is a company in Michigan that has bought many resources from Canada. Why? Well, because it was cheaper to do that. It was economically more efficient to buy from Canada than from an American company. That's why they did it. So now they accept money from the government, and so they have to go to their Canadian suppliers and say, oh, well, because we're now accepted this money, we can't buy from you anymore, and we're going to have to find an American supplier. Well, what happens to jobs in Canada? What happens to jobs in Mexico? It's essentially like a trade war. See, we're saying, well, we've got an economic problem here, and so we're going to buy less from you, so buy more from ourselves. Well, all we're doing is trying to export our unemployment problem. With us buying less from Canada and us buying less from Mexico, they're going to experience more unemployment because we're a big purchaser of their products. Now, what do they do in return?
Don't buy from us.
Yeah. See, Mexico, for example, has just published a list of products that they say we're no longer going to buy these products from America. There's many companies in California especially that is going out of business now because their main customer was Mexico. And Mexico said, well, we're not going to buy your products anymore. Okay, so what are changes in trade over the past 20 years? Exports, an increase in the export of machinery. Imports, an increase in the purchase of oil. So we still do export certain things, but it's very much on a been on a decline. In terms of purchasing of oil, we're still very dependent upon foreign oil, but what has happened to the demand for oil worldwide because of the worldwide recession? If people, when the economy starts head south and virtually all countries in the world are heading south, I mean, they're all experiencing economic problems, well, people drive less. And if people drive less, and they buy less, and we're going to ship resources around less, then there's a lower demand for oil. So we're still very much dependent upon foreigners for our oil, but on a worldwide basis, there's been a great decline in the demand for oil because of most economies are experiencing such severe economic problems and growing unemployment. Okay, does specialization increase productivity? Yes, by each country specializing in a certain export, non-productive activity is lessened. You all remember we talked back in chapter 3 or 4, there's a chapter on productivity. We talked about Henry Ford as an example of an innovative person. When I mention Henry Ford and the Ford Automobile Company, what comes to your mind? What made Henry Ford so successful? I think most people think, well, the assembly line. Why is the assembly line technique at production so productive?
Faster.
But why is it faster and cheaper? Yeah, specialization of labor, exactly right. See what the assembly line is all about is, well, we're going to divide up the labor, and instead of the skilled craftsman technique where one person maybe worked with two or three others as a team and they assembled an entire automobile, Henry Ford's idea was, well, let's have 100 or 200 men in the line and give each man, we'll divide up the labor. And we'll give each man a very specialized task. And we back there, I'm not going to go through this again, but we learned that when you divide up the labor this way, then this greatly increases productivity. Now, here's the point. If you can picture Henry Ford in the assembly line, and you can picture these assembly line workers, I want you to picture each of those workers being a different country. Now, if you look at it on a worldwide basis, I mean, if you get away from Henry Ford and the assembly line in the factory somewhere, if you look at it as a worldwide basis, and if we trade with other nations and other nations specialize, instead of trying to do it all themselves, if each one specializes, if we divide up the labor on a worldwide basis, then what happens to productivity overall? For all those reasons that we talked about in that earlier chapter, productivity will greatly increase. The more we divide up the labor, the more productivity increases. Now, when businesses increase their productivity, which means that they can produce more at lower costs, what do they do to their prices? Yeah, they lower the prices. And why they lower the prices? To buy more. We lower the prices so we can sell more. And as we lower our prices, what happens to the buying power of consumers? It goes up. People can afford to buy more. So people buy more. Their standard of living increases because prices have gone down for those goods and services that they buy. And as they buy more, business sells more. Business is going to want to produce more. And therefore, we get more jobs. See, it's a win-win situation. Higher standard of living, higher profits, more jobs. And this is the basis behind international trade. The base behind international trade is that, hey, see, the country's resources are not evenly distributed around the globe. I mean, certain countries have certain resources where other countries have a different set of resources. See, we're not, in terms of weather and the climate and the raw materials of the country, and sometimes it's a matter of being developed or not developed, or sometimes it's a matter of a tradition in terms of the things that we've produced going way back. I mean, there's lots of factors here, a lot of factors. But the point is that there's a great deal of a variety as you go around the globe. And so what we're saying here is that because of this great diversification, if each country were to specialize, if we were to divide up the labor, instead of each country trying to do it all themselves, as we divide up the labor, then in a worldwide basis, productivity increases and everybody gains. Everybody in all countries gains. So this is the whole point behind international trade. Now, the question is, okay, if we know that countries should specialize, and therefore we can more divide up the labor, then a question arises, well, what should a country specialize in? And that's what we're going to talk about next. In those goods and services that has a comparative advantage. True or false? In order for a country to succeed, it ought to produce those goods and services that it is best at producing. That's false. How come that's false?
Because we have to consider the comparative.
Consider. Comparative. Yeah, exactly. Exactly right. That's the precise answer. Because in our decision making, we have to consider our opportunity costs. And we want to trade based on our comparative advantage, not our absolute advantage. See, if we were to produce those things that we were best at producing, then we would be producing based on our absolute advantage. What does absolute advantage mean? Absolute advantage means that we can produce something better than everyone else. That's what absolute advantage means. Now, we talked about this in an earlier chapter, so I don't have to go into it in length as I did before, but the example I gave in this earlier chapter is what would happen if America was best at producing handmade wicker baskets. Therefore, we would have an absolute advantage in making these wicker baskets. Now, does that mean that we ought to devote our time and energy to making wicker baskets? And the answer, of course, not. And how does opportunity cost fit in here? I mean, think of those wicker baskets. Why would we not want to devote a lot of time and energy to making wicker baskets? Because what's our opportunity cost?
High.
But what is it? I mean, it's high, but what is our opportunity cost?
Whatever you could be making something else.
But what is that for America?
Technology.
Technology, maybe. That's a good answer. In other words, if we put an hour, they're going to spend an hour to devote their time and energy to making this wicker basket. That means they can't spend that hour somewhere in the high-tech field.
Right.
See, we have an opportunity cost here. We can't do two things at the same time. If you do one, then you can't at the same time do the other. Well, which way would we be better off making a handmade wicker basket in an hour or devoting our time in that hour to something in the high-tech field? Because we are an advanced industrialized country, because we have a high level of capacity here, we would be much better off devoting our time to something in the high-tech field as opposed to making a handmade wicker basket. See, if that's why that statement is false, well, okay, we're better than anyone else making wicker baskets. We have an absolute advantage in making wicker baskets. Does that mean that we ought to do it? Well, no, it doesn't. Why? Because we don't have a comparative advantage in making these wicker baskets. Why don't we have a comparative advantage? Because our opportunity costs are so high. Remember, in terms of decision making, and what's microeconomics all about? Microeconomics is all about the decision making process of economics. Now, when we make decisions, when you personally make decisions, then if you are aware of your opportunity cost, because every time you make a decision, no matter what that decision is, you incur an opportunity cost, right? Every decision you've ever made in your life has always been involved with an opportunity cost. Therefore, what we learn in economics is we've got to learn to make decisions based on our opportunity cost. Not based on what we can do best, but based on our opportunity cost. Now, which decisions do we want to make? Well, we want to make those decisions whereby those things that we devote our time and energy to, we have low opportunity costs. And we do not want to devote our time and energy to those pursuits where we have high opportunity costs. See, that is the way to prosperity. The way to prosperity, I mean, everything else being equal, is to be aware of our opportunity cost and make decisions based on our opportunity cost and to do those things where we have a comparative advantage, not necessarily an absolute advantage. Comparative advantage means we can do something with low opportunity costs. Absolute advantage says we can do this better than other people. And it's the comparative advantage that's more important than absolute advantage. See, I got ahead of myself again. So slide 18 says, what is comparative advantage? Producing something with lower opportunity cost than others. See, it's just a way of thinking. You know, I've talked about this before in terms of economics. So much of economics is learning a pattern of thinking. It's a thought process. I mean, you learn the vocabulary, you learn the concepts, and then after that, you learn a certain thought process. That's what economics is all about. I mean, why is it that some students, some of you maybe, have difficulties on these tests? Because you're trying to rely on your memory. You think economics is learning facts and learning figures and it doesn't work that way. Economics is a thought pattern. It's a thought pattern. And this is a good example of that. A thought pattern in here in terms of, oh, I got to make a decision. I'm going to make a decision based on my opportunity costs. You see, that's a thought pattern. Okay, I've already talked about absolute advantage. Slide 19. What should a country produce? It should produce those things in which it has a comparative advantage. Slide 20. What is an example of a comparative advantage? Even if Americans were best at making wicker baskets, our opportunity cost would be very high in this activity. Slide 21. What is the good enough rule? The good enough rule is, all right, let's say that other countries can't make wicker baskets as good as we can. I mean, let's say that we have an absolute advantage in making these wicker baskets. But because we're going to make decisions based on comparative advantage, what we're saying is, well, some other countries may not be able to make these wicker baskets as good as we can, but their opportunity costs are so much lower than ours when making a wicker basket that they ought to make those baskets. We have to devote our time to where our opportunity costs are low and then trade. Well, now the question is, well, how good can that foreign country make these wicker baskets? I mean, they can't make them as good as we can, but can they make them good enough? And that's what I call the good enough rule. The good enough rule, I mean, good enough is good enough. Okay, they can't make them as good as we can, but can they make them good enough? Now, if they can make them good enough, maybe not as good as we can, like I said, but good enough. Well, if they can make them good enough, let them make the baskets and let us devote our time to the high-tech field and then trade. Then we can buy their baskets from them and they can perhaps buy our more advanced high-tech products from us. And therefore, both of us gain. So what are the reasons for international specialization? Differences in resources, economies of scale, differences in tastes. I mean, there's lots of reasons why countries have differences in terms of their ability and to produce goods and services. Now, when will we trade? When the world price is greater than our price, we will export. When the world price is greater than our price, then we will export. Why? Well, because that means that we can compete on the international market and we can sell things at a lower price than other countries. And so other countries will say, hey, we're looking all over the world here. Where should we buy this thing? Well, by gosh, we can buy it from America and get it at a lower price. And assuming that, you know, always consider the good enough rule. Now, what happens, though, if the world price is less than our price? Well, if the world price is less than our price, in other words, we're producing something, but we could buy the same thing from other countries. So when the world price is less than our price, that means that we should import those things. That says, oh, well, maybe we shouldn't produce it ourselves. Instead, we ought to produce from foreign countries. Now, what happens if the world price equals our price? Well, really, it makes no difference then. I mean, if we buy from other countries or we produce these things ourselves, there's really no difference. And because there's no difference, then by default, see, I have here will not trade. I mean, why should we trade with other countries if it really makes no difference? I mean, it's easier to buy from ourselves if that's the case. So really the default here would be if the world price equals our price, then we'll buy from ourselves. Even though in terms of dollars and cents, it makes no difference. Okay, slide 25. When would a high-wage worker be cheaper than a low-wage worker? Now, here's something that's interesting. Let's take a manufacturing company, for example. And the CEOs of this manufacturing company says, look, we can produce our product here in America, or we can go to a foreign country where the wage is so much lower. I mean, maybe we got to pay an American worker $15 an hour, but we can go to a foreign country and pay that foreign worker $1 an hour. Now, is it cheaper to go to that foreign country instead of making that product at home? What do you think? All right, you got a choice. You own a manufacturing company, let's say. You've got a choice. Make it in America, pay $15 an hour, make it in a foreign country, pay $1 an hour. Now, which is cheaper? I'd say that in many cases, to make it in America, is cheaper. How come? See, what's missing from this analysis here? You say, okay, we can produce something here and pay American worker $15 an hour. We can produce it in a foreign country, pay the American worker $1 an hour. Well, what am I missing here? I mean, I'm only telling you half the story. What's the other half of the story? Okay, we can pay an American worker $15 an hour. We can pay a foreign worker $1 an hour. Now, what's missing? What's missing is how much are we going to get back from that worker? How productive is that worker? Right? See, it's inputs, outputs. Okay, we pay an American worker $15 an hour, but what can that American worker do? How productive can that American worker be in that hour? Okay, we pay a foreign worker $1 an hour, but what do we can get back for our dollar? How productive is that foreign worker? See, let's say we pay an American worker $15 an hour, and an hour that American worker can produce something that has a value of $100. Okay, we pay him $15, he produces something, we sell it in the market for $100. Now, we pay a foreign worker $1 an hour, but he can only produce something in an hour that has a value of $2. Okay, we pay the foreign worker $1 an hour, he makes something that has a value of $2, we sell it in the market for $2. Now, which is a better deal? The American worker is a better deal. Even though we're paying him more per per hour, it's a better deal. You all follow me on this? See, you're going to pay someone, but what he can get back for that money? Now, the mistake that a lot of American companies have made is that they say, oh, well, we can go to a foreign country and pay so much less to those workers, but when they go to that foreign country, sometimes they find that the productivity of that foreign worker is so low that actually, despite the lower wage, it's more expensive. Now, what are some reasons why the productivity of that foreign worker, I mean, we're talking here mainly about a smaller developing country compared to America. What are some reasons why that foreign worker may be much less productive than the American worker? Now, you might say, well, maybe that foreign worker doesn't work as hard. I mean, maybe their work ethic is not as good as the American worker. And that may be a factor in some cases. But that's not usually the main reason, if it is a reason at all.
They have a better incentive for work?
I mean, why is it the American worker is so productive? What's one reason? There are lots of reasons. Okay, let's talk about this. Why would the American worker be very productive? Now, we're comparing an American worker manufacturing something and a foreign worker manufacturing that same thing in their country.
Better treatment, like better health care.
What about the education level? I mean, you're talking about a poor developing country. What is the probability of the American worker being more educated than the foreign worker? Well, if the American worker is more educated, then that American worker can be so much more productive. I mean, simple things like sometimes American companies have gone to foreign countries and they've had to train their workers just to use a telephone. Because, I mean, that country doesn't have telephones. The foreign worker maybe only have the equivalent of a second or third grade education. You know, they can hardly read and write. And maybe what you're doing requires this, you know, some reading, some writing. Well, you got a high learning curve here. That's part of it. But now, probably the biggest part is So often a worker is productive not because of the worker alone, but because of the system the worker is working in. See, it's the system. I mean, if we here in America have a good road system, we have a good power system, we have a good communication system, we have more advanced machinery, more productive machinery. We have, you see what I mean? I mean, a worker in America may be more productive, not because he necessarily is more educated, or it's not that maybe he's got a better work ethic, although those things may exist, but he's more productive because he is working within a system, an infrastructure that enables him to be more productive. Whereas in a foreign country, maybe the road system is very poor. The communication system is very poor. Maybe the telephones only work every other day. You see what I mean? I mean, they don't have the cell towers that we do. They don't have the communication system we do. They don't have the transportation system that we do. And it's because of the infrastructure that this foreign worker is working in makes the foreign worker so much less productive than the American worker. Now, y'all follow me on this? Now, generally speaking, which jobs, when would it be a good idea for an American company to go into a foreign country and start manufacturing? And generally speaking, when would it be a better idea to do it at home? In other words, what kind of jobs are gone to foreign countries? Some manufacturing jobs are labor intensive and some are capital intensive. Now, what does it mean that to say that a job is capital intensive? That means that the worker is working with a machine, let's say, with a computer, could be an example. See, that's capital intensive. When a worker is productive, not because that worker can work longer or harder or even has a better work ethic, but that worker is more productive because they have more capital to work with. They have better machines to work with. That's what we call a job that is very capital intensive. Now, a job that's very labor intensive means that, well, this job here is not conducive to capital, and it's just very labor intensive. Like sewing might be a labor intensive job. You know, someone has to operate that sewing machine, and maybe some of these things that that worker do can't be automated very well. I don't know I can't think of, you know, some very good examples, but the point I'm making is that some jobs are a very labor-intensive with very low capital requirement, and other jobs are high capital. I mean, they're very capital-intensive type jobs. Now, which jobs would an American company be better off perhaps in a foreign country? A capital intensive or labor intensive? Labor intensive. You see, our advantage in terms of manufacturing or production is that we are a very capital intensive country. Why? Well, because we've got a modern infrastructure. We've got modern transportation. We've got communication systems, electrical systems, power systems. See, we are very capital intensive. Therefore, a job that is very capital intensive would probably be better off staying in this country. But if you're an owner of a company and whatever it is that you're manufacturing is very labor intensive, then maybe you'd be better off going to that foreign country. And even that's a maybe. It's not a sure thing. But generally speaking, it's the labor intensive jobs that are really better in doing it in foreign countries to take advantage of the lower foreign wages. Because the use of capital is not very much of a factor here. But if you're talking about a capital-intensive type job, then even though you can pay that foreign worker a whole lot less per hour, it could be a whole lot more expensive going to that foreign country because of their insufficient capital structure. Okay, so I'm on slide 25. When would a high-wage worker be cheaper than a low-wage worker? When the high-wage worker is a lot more productive than the low-wage worker. Okay, I just explained that. What makes one worker more productive than another? Better infrastructure, capital, education, skills, attitude. We talked about all these things, right? Again, I got ahead of myself. Now, why have trade restrictions? Okay, well, now what we've done here is we said, okay, because the world's resources are not evenly distributed around the globe, that free trade is therefore better for everybody. I mean, if all countries could freely trade amongst themselves, and each of those countries made decisions of what to produce based on their comparative advantage, then all countries would be better off. That productivity overall would increase, and everybody in all countries would enjoy a higher standard of living. Now that is a fact. Now the question is, okay, if free trade is best, and if free trade allows us, each country, to take advantage of their comparative advantage, then why do we have trade restrictions? And well, and I'm not going to start this. This is a whole different area that we're going to go into now. The second half of this chapter is, okay, free trade is best, but there are reasons, some are good reasons, and some are bad reasons, why we have trade restrictions. So what we're going to learn next time is, okay, what are these reasons, what are good reasons, and when are... is it bad for us to have trade restrictions? Okay? So any questions about any of this? All right, well, I'll finish this chapter next time. So I'll see you all next time.